Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll hear an interview from our archives with Snow Hill artist Paul Volcker. We'll learn about those tributes to our local Native American tribes called the Whispering Giants. And naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about Milford Neck Wildlife Area and Preserve. This past year, Paul Volcker opened his new studio gallery, called The Green Pearl, in Snow Hill, Maryland, where visitors have a window on the creative process of this unusual artist. He and I met up just before its grand opening. Here's that story. Paul had an early interest in cartooning, which evolved into work as a painter with a sense of humor. He attended Ohio State University for 3 years before jumping into his career full-time.
I had become so busy at that time doing actual art jobs for people, I thought, well, this is why I'm in school, so I was spending so much time doing that, I really didn't have time to do more of the academic stuff. However, I continued to be involved at the university, and I used to sit in on classes and participate in my spare time, which the professors liked. Found myself doing graphics, primarily in cartooning, graphics, menu designs, and things like graphic arts, and a lot of cartooning and illustration work for people. And then I was working on a mural for somebody on the front of a building one time, and really started to become fond of paints at that time, especially house paint. And I had been using ordinary art supply paint, acrylics, but I had a lot of gallons of acrylic house paint left over. I started using those, and now that's my preferred medium. And a friend of mine who does paint restoration, she said, oh, 100 years from now, they're going to love you. They'll just be able to go down to a hardware store and, you know, match the color.
Paul has done thousands of paintings showing various animals doing very human things, like drinking espresso. When you look at them, you can't miss his sense of whimsy.
Animals are a very good way of conveying the human experience and in a humorous way. And humor is actually the focus of my work. And humor is a highly regarded means of expression in theater, in television, in literature. I mean, the longest running TV shows are the Simpsons, things that are funny. But in the art world, humor is relegated to a very low status. It's like gags, or it's a joke, and once you get it, the painting's done. But I think it's possible to work on that more, really explore humor as a valid theme in art.
Mark Twain once remarked that in terms of humor, the further the pendulum swings out over woe, the further it is bound to swing back over mirth. Paul's animal paintings give the viewer a good laugh while poking fun at what is sometimes the darker side of the human condition.
Animals are funny because there's a lot of cruelty in the animal world, in nature. You know, you watch the old nature programs of, you know, big fish eating little fish and tigers eating, or lions eating gazelles or whatever. And it's not really cruelty to animals, that's just survival. But in terms of humans, it's a good way to reflect on the way humans relate to each other. Some of my favorite animals to paint are crocodiles and bears. I sort of just make it up as I go along. I don't invest a whole lot of sentimentality to my work. And although I do want my work to bring a lot of joy to people when they see it. I'm not too attached to it. And part of the reason is because I find that actually for me to be very inhibiting to do that. That's one of the reasons I use house paint on plywood, is because expensive art materials are intimidating to me. And one of my rules is frequently to paint, after I've finished a painting, is to just paint over it, even if it's good, and do another one and just let it go. And that gives me a real sense of freedom that it doesn't matter now that much if I destroy a painting or not. And because of that, I find I'm actually able to really let go and break a lot more rules and be a lot more freer with myself.
Paul's work is evolving from flat images into three dimensions and even working parts. He's using recycled materials like wood and paper pulp mixed with caulk and industrial glue.
It's kind of like paper mache, only it's rock hard. And I like the three-dimensional quality. I like the idea that people could sort of touch it, and because you're not supposed to touch art. And most of my stuff breaks a lot of rules. I don't have frames. I don't use canvas. I don't use oil paints. And you can touch the work. The painting I'm working on right now, which is going to be a very large work, will have 12 interactive pieces that you can actually remove from the painting and play with. But it features 12 old-fashioned TV sets on a board that looks like a store window, like an old TV store.
Paul says that people now often treat artwork more like a souvenir of their experience. For example, they take selfies in galleries and museums rather than more directly enjoying the work they see. His goal is to invite the viewer to break through the barriers that technology has inadvertently placed between them and the artist's work.
The goal of technology these days, with iPhones and iPads and that sort of thing, is to make a 3D interactive experience. So what I'm trying to do is, using the most low-tech material possible, which is house paint on plywood, is to create a 3D interactive television experience. And so I decided to make a series of television sets with knobs on them and black and white images on them, which the user can actually go and turn the knobs and change the picture on the artwork. So it is in fact 3D interactive television, which is the goal of modern technology, but I'm trying to do it in, like I said, a completely rough, even the wood is rough and uneven, and the paint is gloppy. There's nothing smooth about it. It's not like an iPhone, which is completely smooth. This is bumpy and coarse. In the world today, we're getting all of our information on these glass screens, and we're losing that kind of textural quality to our experience. And so I want to create artwork that has that you can feel the texture with your eyes. You can feel some depth. It's not just something behind glass.
You can watch a video of this interview on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts, to see Paul's work and get a link to his website. You'll also find a link to Paul's online auction of his artwork, which begins today and lasts through November 19th. Or why not take a run over to Snow Hill, where you can see Paul Volcker's gallery, The Green Pearl, yourself. Nearby, artists Nancy Thompson and Jim Adcock also have studios that have public hours, along with Bishop Stock Gallery. Art lovers will find Snow Hill is definitely a worthwhile day trip. It's time for our first break now. Stick around. When we come back, we'll hear about those tributes to our local Native American tribes known as the Whispering Giants. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and I'm so glad you're listening today. There are very few first source materials about the pre-European tribes who lived along Delmarva's coast and were known as the Assateagues. Not many artifacts remain to help us really understand their culture. The people have found their arrowheads in this region ever since they were lost to us as a tribe. Much of what we know about them is based on a few early accounts from explorers like Giovanni di Verrazzano and Captain John Smith. The most complete account comes from Henry Norwood, who was stranded on our beaches in 1649. His story tells us a little bit about their culture, but not very much, as most of his communication with them was done through rudimentary hand signals. What we do know is that the Assateague people lived mostly inland near the coastal bays and only traveled to the barrier island to hunt and fish. And eventually they were forced to leave our area and join tribes further north. In the late 20th century, an immigrant artist built the most lasting tribute to native peoples of this area in two of Delmarva's beach towns. In 1976, Peter Toth carved a large statue in Ocean City and one in Bethany Beach as part of a series of statues called the Trail of Whispering Giants. The Ocean City statue, number 21 in the series, is called Nanticoke, paying tribute to the Nanticoke tribe who the Assateagues eventually joined up with in the Oak Orchard area of Delaware. The statue was carved from a 100-year-old oak. Completed in September of that year, it stands 20 feet tall at the southern end of Philadelphia Avenue, facing west across the waters of the Ocean City Harbor. I have heard some folks question why the statue does not face in a direction that makes it easier for people to see. Some speculate that perhaps the artist was making a statement about the Indian looking wistfully back on their lost homeland across the inland bay. When you make the turn, driving from Philadelphia Avenue toward the inlet parking lot, you come face to face with the noble gaze of a native man wearing a single feather in his headband. If you take the time to walk out to it along the observation path, you can see it up close. The visionary artist who created the statue, Peter Wolf Toth, was born in Hungary. He and his family escaped the Soviet takeover of his homeland in 1956 when he was just a small child. They came to the United States after 2 years of living as refugees in Europe. Peter grew up in Ohio and began his career as an artist after some courses at the University of Akron. He followed in the footsteps of his father, who was also an artist. Peter had developed a fascination for the native peoples of America, in part because he identified with their experience of invasion and forced migration, which was so close to his own. In 1972, at the age of only 24, he carved his first tribute to them. It was a large face carved from a cliff in La Jolla, California. His next Indian head was carved from wood. These two pieces inspired him to create similar sculptures in all 50 U.S. states. He became an itinerant artist, traveling from state to state to carve and donate his tributes to indigenous people to their local communities. That's right, donate. He does not ask to be paid for these works of art. Some admirers have donated free lodging and supplies for his efforts, but Peter sees this work as a calling to honor the country that gave his family a permanent refuge from war and poverty and to displaced indigenous people everywhere. If you've just joined us, this is the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is the story of local Native American tributes created by artist Peter Toth. Further north in Bethany Beach is number 22 in the series, which Peter Toth completed in December of 1976. It was carved from a 25-foot poplar log donated by Jones Lumber of Snow Hill, Maryland. It faces west at the intersection of Route 1 and Garfield Parkway. The Bethany Beach sculpture is done more in the tradition of a totem pole, with an eagle or hawk as the Indian's headdress. And it is a tribute to a specific person, Nanticoke Chief Little Owl. This statue did not hold up as well as its counterpart further down the peninsula. Damage from termites and high winds forced the town to take it down and donate what was left of it to the Nanticoke Indian Museum in Oak Orchard in 1992. A local artist named Dennis Beach created a replacement out of white oak, which unfortunately also succumbed to the harsh environmental conditions. In 2002, Peter Toth was asked to create another statue. He returned to Delaware bringing number 69, a new 24-foot version made from Pacific red cedar, in hopes of it lasting a very long time. At the new sculpture's dedication ceremony, a descendant of the statue's namesake, Charlie Little Owl Clark, performed a traditional Nanticoke tribal blessing. Peter Toth's Trail of Whispering Giants now has sculptures in all 50 states and 15 in Canada. He has written a book about his life's work called Indian Giver. He lives in Florida, where he creates smaller sculptures to raise money for the upkeep and creation of new statues for his series, which includes indigenous peoples in countries around the world. In 2006, Peter Toth came back to Ocean City to do some restoration work on number 21, which has for the most part endured decades of storms and summer heat. In 2013, after Superstorm Sandy, the town of Ocean City found that additional restoration work would be needed to repair a split in the wood. This remains an unresolved concern. The Assateagues may be gone, their identity melted into that of the Nanticoke tribe. But Nanticokes are very much alive and well. Their tribe has an active association which advocates for the rights and welfare of their members. They hold an annual powwow celebration with traditional dances every September. And they have a lovely museum on Route 24 in Oak Orchard, Delaware, which is open year-round, showcasing regional artifacts dating back to 8,000 BC, educational heritage displays, and contemporary locally produced crafts. If you'd like to find out more about this topic, visit this story on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On November 15, 1863, a Confederate ship was captured in the waters near Accomack, Virginia. Four sailors of the rebel navy were captured and sent to Cape Charles Point Lookout prison camp, along with a number of civilian blockade runners. And in an unrelated event, less than a week earlier, further up the peninsula on November 11, 1863, Isaiah Fassett was released from bondage by his owner Sarah A. Bruff in Berlin, Maryland, in order to serve in the Union Army. Known to most as Uncle Zeer, at the time of his death in 1946 at the age of 102, he was the last living Civil War veteran on Delmarva. And tomorrow, November 13th, is the birthday of Delmarva native Harry Hughes, the 57th governor of Maryland. Democrat Hughes was born in 1926 in Easton. He served two terms from 1979 to 1987. During his time in office, cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay, trade with China, and a new state archive were all begun. And before he left office, he oversaw a plan to deal with the savings and loan crisis to help insured depositors recover their investments. Happy birthday, Harry! This is the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's Scott Duncan with a few reminders for the end of gardening season.
Did you know that in Maryland, using fertilizer between November 15th and March 1st is now prohibited? The Fertilizer Use Act of 2011 was enacted to help protect the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries from excessive nutrient runoff. So apply one last layer of your compost and wait until spring to try and feed your soil. Before the ground freezes hard, dig up and store tender bulbs such as elephant ears, begonias, and caladium. Mulch beds with spring bulbs and tender shrubs like rosemary, which can also benefit from being wrapped in burlap before frosts can damage them. After the first hard freeze, cut dead annuals and perennials. Discard any that are diseased and add the rest to the compost pile. Leaves can be helpful mulch for lawns. Rather than raking them up, use your mower to shred them and leave them for the winter. Keep the layer of leaves to about an inch and put the rest of the leaves on flower beds. After the last mowing of the season, clean up your mower and wipe it down with WD-40 to prevent rust during winter storage. If your mower has a battery, remove it and store it in a protected place until the spring. Compost all winter long to have nice soil in the spring. Buy a commercial bin or dedicate an out-of-the-way spot in your yard. You can also dig a trench for winter composting and then use the trench to plant in the spring with a favorite vegetable crop. During cold weather, the composting process slows down, so turn your compost pile every 2 weeks once temperatures are consistently below 50 degrees. If you have a koi pond, clean up leaves and other debris and put a wire cover on it to protect the fish. They will not need to be fed during cold weather.
Thanks, Scott. By the way, on another gardening note, if you're planning to give forced bulbs as a holiday gift, it's a good idea to get them potted and started now if you want them to bloom by the end of December. Let's take another break now. We won't be gone long, and when we come back, Jim Rapp will tell us about some natural wonders found near Milford, Delaware. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about the Milford Neck Wildlife Area and Nature Preserve near Milford, Delaware.
Delmarva is truly blessed with exceptional wildlife watching opportunities, thanks in large part to our famous National Wildlife Refuges. Birders and wildlife photographers the world over know our peninsula from such places as Chincoteague, Blackwater, and Bombay Hook. Delmarva's refuges form a network of lands and waters spared from development for the conservation and restoration of wildlife and the habitats that support them. Famed conservationist Aldo Leopold taught that land is a community of life and that love and respect for the land is an extension of ethics. Guided by Leopold's teachings, the public servants who manage our refuges seek to reflect that land ethic in their stewardship practices. This stewardship ethic does not stop at the boundaries of our federally managed wildlife refuges. Dotted across Delmarva's landscape are hidden treasures managed for wildlife by state governments and not-for-profit organizations. Thousands of acres of state-managed lands are known as wildlife areas in Delaware and wildlife management areas in Maryland and Virginia. Lands managed by nonprofits such as the Nature Conservancy and Delaware Wildlands usually call these special places preserves. Several agencies in Delaware have been working cooperatively to manage and restore wildlife habitat in an area northeast of Milford, Delaware, known as Milford Neck. The term neck refers to a narrow stretch of land, and Milford Neck stretches for 10,000 acres from Milford all the way to 10 protected miles of Delaware Bayshore between Bombay Hook and Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuges. The Milford Neck landscape can best be described as a patchwork of contiguous protected land that includes upland forests, wet woods, open fields, expansive marshes, and undeveloped dunes and beaches leading to the Delaware Bay. Milford Neck is a stellar example of cooperation between public and private agencies working together to protect one of the first state's most ecologically important zones. The lands are owned and managed by the State of Delaware, the Nature Conservancy, Delaware Wildlands, and many private landowners. To restore ecologically compromised marshes within the Milford Neck Conservation Area, partner agencies are working to heal the damage caused by old ditches that drain tidal marshes and forest. Combined with the impacts of major storms and sea level rise, ditches transform marsh to open water and deliver tree-killing salt water to the forest at the western edge of Milford Neck. Intensive forest restoration at Milford Neck has included planting thousands of native hardwood trees and other vegetation that create habitat islands. The islands include several species of oak, southern arrowwood, and persimmon. Birds attracted to the shelter provided by these islands feed on the fruits and seeds of the trees, which naturally aids in forest regeneration. Due to the incredible habitat diversity on display here, Milford Neck has become one of Delaware's best birding areas. The wildlife area and preserves have been recognized for their importance to songbirds, shorebirds, and waterfowl as an important stopover during migration. This is Jim Rapp, and you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. We're talking about the birds of the Milford Neck Wildlife Area and Nature Preserves. Several species of warbler sensitive to forest fragmentation find refuge in Milford Neck's forest during spring and summer. Milford Neck is the only remaining forested area greater than 1,000 acres on the Delaware coast. Hooded warbler, Kentucky warbler, and worm-eating warbler have all been documented in Milford Neck. Black-billed cuckoos and whippoorwills have also been found in the forest here. The marshes of Milford Neck provide habitat for rails, including the elusive but fairly common clapper rail and the incredibly hard-to-find black rail. The expansive shoreline of the Delaware Bay serves as resting and foraging habitat for shorebirds and waterfowl migrating along the North Atlantic Flyway. The bayshore at Milford Neck hosts more than 1 million migratory shorebirds that visit each spring to feed on eggs laid by horseshoe crabs. Milford Neck is an important component of the new Delaware Bayshore Initiative, a collaborative effort to build on the Delaware Coast's reputation as a unique and beautiful natural resource. The Bayshore Initiative was created to help improve the coastal economy by encouraging more locals and visitors to enjoy it through activities such as birding, fishing, hunting, and boating. You can explore the Milford Neck Wildlife Area from the intersection of Route 1 and Tub Mill Pond Road, which is close to Medding & Son Seafood, a popular restaurant with a giant gold propeller out front. Turn east from Medding & Son, and you will find a small parking lot with public access about 1 mile down the road. Consult the current schedule of hunting seasons before hiking, and be advised that wildlife areas keep signage to a minimum, so it may be wise to pack a compass or GPS unit. You can also drive along Big Stone Beach Road, which will take you through Milford Neck's coastal forest, marshes, and out to the Delaware Bayshore. If you're birding in the winter, keep your eyes open for northern harriers hunting over the open marsh. Harriers, also known as marsh hawks, are easy to spot from a distance. This large, slender hawk glides low over the marsh with its broad wings held up in the shape of the letter V. It's pretty easy to distinguish male harriers from females by their color and body size. Males are smaller than females and have gray backs and white bellies with black wingtips and a long, black-banded tail. Females and immature birds are brown above. Adult females have whitish undersides with brown streaks, while immature harriers are buffy below with fewer streaks. Males, females, and immature birds have a white patch at the base of the tail that can be seen in flight. Northern harriers have a flat, owl-like face and a small, hooked bill. They fly low over the marsh when hunting, weaving to and fro as they watch and listen for small animals. Harriers are the most owl-like of hawks, and they rely on hearing as well as vision to capture their prey. The stiff facial feathers on their disc-shaped face help direct sound to their ears. Northern harriers mostly hunt small mammals and birds, but they can take bigger prey like muskrats and ducks. They are known to kill larger animals by drowning them in the waters of the marsh. When they're not flying, northern harriers can be found perched on short snags or old signposts in the open marsh. Next time you're making a birding trip to Bombay Hook or Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuges, add a tour through Milford Neck's wildlife area and nature preserves. You'll be amazed with the quality of the coastal habitat managed for wildlife by Delaware state and nonprofit conservation partners, and you'll be rewarded with an impressive species tally at the end of your trip.
Thanks, Jim. I'll definitely be adding that to my list of places to go birding. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.